At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A new year, an old fiscal cliff. What's holding up a deal in the House? And some advice for our Congress from fed-up New Yorkers and austerity-worn Greeks. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, January 1st. Happy New Year! And we actually have real news on New Year's Day. It's not just football and parades this time around. On the heels of this morning's fiscal cliff vote in the U.S. Senate, the drama has now shifted to the House, where members are still debating the details of the Senate bill. Bottom line, it raises taxes on some wealthy Americans, and it puts off deep spending cuts for another few months. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer joins us to talk about the latest developments. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, Sarah.
Well, there's apparently a hitch in the House. What's happening today?
You know, Sarah, I know it's New Year's Day, but honestly, it feels a lot more like Groundhog Day here in Washington.
Yeah.
Once again, there is gridlock on Capitol Hill. I know you're shocked. Leaders of both parties are trying to get their troops in line. They're trying to support the bill the Senate passed in the very wee hours of this morning. Vice President Biden met with House Democrats today, and he actually camped out for a while. He went out a couple blocks from the Capitol and got lunch for his staff and sat there and ate lunch. Democrats came out of that meeting today saying it was a very bipartisan bill that was passed in the Senate. And House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said they were ready to vote on the Senate bill.
It's long overdue for us to have this solution to go forward and remove all doubt as to what comes next for our country. So we expect the American people deserve an up or down vote on what was passed in the Senate.
So, Nancy, what is the main hang-up at this point?
Yeah, why hasn't the House voted on this bill? Some House Republicans say they really don't like the Senate bill. House Speaker John Boehner has not taken a public position on the bill. Apparently, in the meetings that were held today with House GOP members, he really didn't say much. He did a lot of listening. Apparently, he got a lot of complaints about the Senate bill. But the House Majority Leader, Eric Cantor, says he does not support the Senate bill. He actually has come out and said that. A number of House Republicans have complained the Senate bill doesn't cut spending enough, that it focuses too much on tax increases. Now, I know that we do focus on the numbers here at Marketplace, Sarah, but you have to look behind the numbers a little bit. Yeah, they say that they're concerned that the Senate bill doesn't focus enough on cutting spending.
Right.
But many of these members of Congress are getting a lot of pressure from their districts. Many of their districts are very polarized, and the members are afraid that if they're perceived as stepping out of line by voting for the Senate bill, that they'll pay later. There are party activists, there are super PACs with lots of money waiting in the wings to back a challenger in the next primary if they don't like what their member of Congress is doing. So the upshot of this is, brace yourself. The House could amend the Senate bill and send it back to the Senate.
Aye, aye, aye. So the upshot, a lot of politics going on. But, Nancy, what's the upshot for taxpayers?
Yeah. Well, you know, we did go over the fiscal cliff this morning, so our taxes have already gone up. The Senate bill would have only raised taxes on families making more than $450,000 a year or individuals with incomes over $400,000. But of course, that bill is still in limbo. So everybody's taxes have gone up.
Technically, yes.
And that includes the Social Security payroll tax. We talked a lot about that. There was a payroll tax holiday, but that's over. And by the way, the payroll tax goes up in the Senate bill, too. So we can pretty much assume that payroll tax is going to go back up to where it was,
right,
up 2 percentage points to 6.2%. Now, Sarah, I'm going to digress just a little bit here, and I'm going to quote my mom.
Okay, just stay
with me here, okay? All right. So my parents own a small business, and they have a couple of employees, and the employees are concerned that the payroll tax is going up. But my mom said to them, you know, keep in mind the money from that Social Security payroll tax goes toward your Social Security.
Right.
So it's
right.
really not such a bad thing that it's going back up to where it was, because you'll be saving more toward your Social Security. Your paycheck may go down a bit now, but your Social Security check will be a bit higher when you retire.
Right. So advice from Mother Marshall on this New Year's Day, Nancy Marshall Genzer in our D.C. Bureau. Nancy, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. It's New Year's Day. Get out your resolutions, folks. I read today that this whole New Year resolution thing started with the Babylonians. They apparently were fond of resolving to pay off debts and returning stuff they had borrowed the year before. Something for all of us to think about. Congress might want to make some new resolutions, too, but they may need some help in that department. So we hit the streets of New York City to gather some suggestions.
Just take a pay cut and give it to the middle class, like me, and the poor.
More like long-term planning instead of short-term. A lot of it's been short-term deals. We had the problem, you know, the debt ceiling. It seems like it's more of just, patching the system instead of actually fixing it.
Congress should resolve to start thinking about the country first. That means to kind of get together, find out what's needed. They should go back to old-time politics and do a bipartisan consensus. You know, they've got a job to do. Just do their job.
Well, I have a habit of waiting to the last minute, and a lot of times it's not good. It's not good for the other people around me. But I feel that they should not wait till the end of the year. There should be a cutoff. It should be all settled, say, by the end of November. For me, there was no reason for them to wait the last minute. I swear to God, they do it on purpose. I really do. They do it on purpose.
Okay, from the streets of New York City to London, where Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports they're not buying into this whole fiscal fiasco thing.
If any Brits were holding their breath, hearts pounding at the thought of America plunging into economic doom, Ruth Lee of the Arbuthnot Bank wasn't one of them.
I never expected them to go tumbling over the cliff. Let's be absolutely frank about this, because the consequences for the American economy would have been too severe.
Almost all analysts, investors and commentators here predicted that the US would pull back from the cliff edge at the last moment. But still, there's widespread dissatisfaction with the congressional deal to avert disaster. Jan Randolph of IHS Global Insight calls it living from cliffhanger to cliffhanger.
They've averted the worst, but only for the time being. We wait for the next cliffhanger, which is probably the debt negotiations.
There is an irony here. The US has spent the last 2 years berating Europe for failing to take decisive action to tackle its government debt. for kicking the can down the road. Analyst Louise Cooper.
This is the Americans doing just the same as the Europeans. And what's interesting is that it can only do it because their central banks are printing money.
She says printed money on both sides of the pond has bought politicians time as they grapple ineffectually with public debt. And that includes Britain, the supposed poster child of austerity. In spite of all the sound and fury about budget cutting, over the next 5 years, Britain's national debt is expected to rise by 50%. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Stock markets were closed for New Year's, but tomorrow, let the fiscal cliff reaction begin. Heading into the new year, perhaps you, like a lot of Americans, have resolved to get in shape. For some of us, hiring a personal trainer is the way to go. It's not hard to find one, whether it's somebody at the local Y or a guy holding exercise boot camps at the park. But as Gigi Duban reports from Birmingham, Alabama, it's not a risk-free enterprise.
As a personal trainer, Nevena Stefanov treads a fine line between pushing her clients and knowing when to back off.
The goal of this one is to go as heavy as you can, as quick as you can.
It's important because even personal trainers can take things too far.
You cannot just go out there and say, well, you gotta go up in weight unless the form is done properly.
And proper form is one of those things a trainer would learn after months or even years of study and experience. But the industry is completely unregulated, and it's easy to get certified as a personal trainer. Walter Thompson teaches exercise science at Georgia State University.
In the course of this conversation, you and I could be certified by about a dozen different certification organizations as long as we had internet access and a good credit card.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics projects 60,000 new personal trainer jobs in the next 7 years. That's a growth of 24%. But as more trainers join the ranks, complaints against them are on the rise too. Especially injury claims. People who insure personal trainers tell me some of the most common cases involve injuries around things like popped exercise balls. Sexual abuse complaints are also on the rise. Many more cases deal with doing too much. Thompson has seen this in dozens of legal cases against personal trainers where he's been an expert witness.
So the client then becomes injured because they're overtraining or they're simply pushed too hard.
Some people have died. And you know who gets blamed? The trainer. Take this case Thompson saw of a 77-year-old woman with lung disease and dementia in Georgia.
The personal trainer said, go over to the treadmill, turn it on, and start walking. Well, she turned it on, and the speed was too fast. She fell off and ended up with a knee replacement. The knee got infected, and eventually she died.
But Thompson says negligence isn't always the issue. It's lack of experience or a flimsy certification. That's why he and others in his field are pushing lawmakers in some states to adopt standards for the industry. After all, experts estimate claims like these cost the industry $20 to $30 million a year. It's tough to gauge, though, since a lot of personal trainers never bother to get insurance. And many of these cases settle out of court. Catherine Hutt, spokeswoman for the Council of Better Business Bureaus, says she's seen complaints go up in the last few years. But it's not all bad.
What I am very happy to see is that inquiries are up at a much greater rate, which means people are checking out personal trainers before they hire them.
So at the very least, people seem to be doing their homework. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
So we're asking today what your financial New Year's resolutions are, and here's a few. Chuck writes on Facebook, the cookies. I need to stop with the cookies. Lisa writes, stop buying shoes. Oh, wait, too late. Seriously, though, I'm going to unsubscribe from all the flash sale sites to remove temptation and or impulse purchases. And George writes, I will buy no books, music, or movies and just read, listen, and watch what I have on the shelf. Now, that's harsh. Your resolutions, tell us on our Facebook page. Coming up, as U.S. lawmakers play chicken with austerity, long struggling Europeans have a simple message.
If you can, of course, you should avoid falling into this fiscal cliff.
But first, let's do a different kind of numbers. 10, the number of states that raise their hourly minimum wages. The highest of the bunch is Washington State, which goes up to $9.19 today. The national minimum is $7.25 an hour. 4.8% is the expected jump for in-state tuition at public universities in 2013. 3.9%, that's the rise in tuition prices for private colleges last year, the smallest rise in the last 40 years. The average tuition at private schools is now $29,305. And 0, the number of food items that need price tags in Massachusetts. It's the last state to eliminate the practice of individually labeling things like canned goods and cereal. A new Massachusetts law allows grocery stores to just put signs on shelves rather than a price sticker on every single item.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for November. The Louisville Cardinals and the Florida Gators face off in the 79th All-State Sugar Bowl in New Orleans. And on January 2nd, 1974, driving 55 became a federal law when President Nixon signed the Emergency Highway Energy Conservation Act. Thank God that's been repealed. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Ryssdal. The down-to-the-wire negotiations, the political wrangling, the shouting pundits on cable TV. This fiscal cliff stuff is a heck of a way to ring in the new year. As we heard earlier from Stephen Beard, Britain is not too rattled about our fiscal squabblings. Anybody else paying attention?
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
Time now for What's Up Europe, and today we check in with our friends in Greece and Spain. We rang up Yanni Palaiologos and Miguel Ancho Morado. They both write about the European economy. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Now, you know, a lot of Americans have been glued to the fiscal cliff negotiations in Washington. Are Europeans paying attention to this debate, Yanni? What about in Greece?
I have to say that in Greece, I mean, maybe they've heard about this, the concept of the fiscal cliff. Probably very few people can tell you what it is, even people who pay attention to the news.
Huh. Miguel, what about in Spain? Do people in Spain feel that the outcome of this fiscal cliff debate in the United States will affect them somehow, or are they just, do they just not care?
No, they do care, and not just because of the concern about the effect that the fiscal cliff may have in the Spanish economy. But apart from that, there was also a lot of interest of the politics of it, of the inner workings of the American system, which is so different from our multi-party system, in which you don't have this grand bargaining or bipartisanship. These things have been explained in detail, not least because people were a little bit baffled by the whole thing, and it's been really it's been spoken in detail in Spain in the media, and it's been a sort of a cliffhanger, if I may say, in a way that, I don't know, Washington D.C. seems to have also a gift for drama.
Yanni, the Greek economy is in such tough shape, and obviously you've been dealing with a very punishing austerity program there. Any advice for Congress that Greeks might give, based on the Greek experience?
Well, I mean, we have been going through successive fiscal cliffs for 3 years now, and we're entering our sixth year of recession. And as everybody knows who's not crazy, if you cut spending and raise taxes at a time when the economy is sluggish, it's going to become a lot more sluggish and probably going to go back into recession. So it would probably be a good idea for them to come together and find some kind of a solution which will prevent the automatic cuts and the tax rises.
Miguel, any thoughts from Spain?
Well, the same. I agree with Gianni. We also had recent tax hikes in Spain and these cutbacks of public spending. And, of course, the effect in the economy is incredible. You really see how businesses struggle. And we still have more trouble ahead in the year that begins now. So if you can, of course, you should avoid falling into this fiscal cliff.
Yanni, what about Greece in the coming year? Where do you see things going for the Greek economy in 2013?
Well, it's going to be probably the toughest year of them all. I mean, like in Spain, our official unemployment rate is already above 25%.
Yanni, say that again. It's above 25%, right?
It's above 25%. Yes, I know it's shocking, so I should say it again. The only hope, and there's been some optimism in the last few weeks of this year, is that this catastrophic discussion about us staying in the euro or leaving the euro is going to stop. So maybe some investment will come in and some jobs will begin to be created and the long slide will begin to be reversed. But it's going to be a very tough year, definitely.
Miguel, what about for Spain? Any hopeful signs for 2013 for the Spanish economy?
Well, not so far. The only hopeful sign is that still we haven't asked for the full bailout for our economy. If we can avoid this full bailout and we can weather the storm this year, and this is a very big if, we will be okay. But that would be not this year, but next year. So there's a long, long way ahead.
Okay. And help me out here. How do you say Happy New Year in both your languages?
Okay, in Spanish is Feliz Año Nuevo.
Yeah. Actually, I did know that. But I couldn't begin to tell you how to say it in Greek. So, Yanni?
It's Καλή Χρονιά.
Okay, I will not repeat that. I'll say Happy New Year to you. Yanni Palaiologos in Greece, Miguel Ancho Morado in Spain. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
When Superstorm Sandy hit the island of Manhattan in October, a lot of New Yorkers started asking themselves, what if this is going to be the new normal? Builders, landscape architects, urban planners, they've all been throwing out proposals for how to shield the famous island from devastating floods in the future. Now, nothing's been approved, but there sure are a lot of ideas floating around, including one from a firm called Architecture Research Office in Manhattan. Stephen Cassell is a partner there. Mr. Cassell, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Now, Lower Manhattan really got hit by Sandy. They had flooding and power outages. Explain to us, why is Lower Manhattan, which includes Wall Street, of course, why is it so vulnerable?
Well, really, it's low-lying areas that got hit. And actually, a lot of Manhattan and Lower Manhattan is landfill that's been added to the island over the past 200 or 300 years.
Huh.
That landfill is pretty low, so it's easily flooded.
Yeah. Now, your firm is proposing a pretty radical design of Lower Manhattan to protect it from flooding in the future, but it does not involve this usual idea of building concrete seawalls. What would you build instead?
Looking at the streets themselves and in all the areas that were flooded, we were proposing redesigning how the city infrastructure works. And we take all the pipes and electrical wires and everything in the street and put them in waterproof vaults under the sidewalk and then make the street bed absorptive that would basically absorb water and channel it back out to the edge of the island.
How do you make a street absorb and make it sort of like a sponge?
That's a good analogy. Really, you'd use what's called porous concrete that the water can soak through it to a series of engineered soils below or a series of channels below.
So it's sort of like you're putting nature back into Manhattan in a way, right?
I think that's a good description. I mean, if you look at the history of Manhattan, really over the past 400 years, went from a natural island with wetlands and marshes and streams. And progressively, as the city developed, these natural systems were sort of forced off the island, replaced with city infrastructure.
Of course, the politicians are going to say, what's it going to cost?
Well, it's not inexpensive, but that's had large barrier islands or large barriers for storm surge are incredibly expensive as well, you know, billions of dollars.
Right.
Really what we look to do is manage water, and you want to layer on solutions so that you're not dependent on one single thing, because if it fails, then you have a catastrophic failure.
Mr. Cassell, what kind of reaction are you getting to this? Because, of course, anything that's done in Lower Manhattan, you're basically tinkering with, altering, you know, you're altering some of the most famous real estate in the country, right?
I think when you look at the cost of these, just the sheer cost in insurance alone, that the equation is going to start to change on how you look at these and how you invest into these type of infrastructure projects in the city.
Stephen Cassell is with the Manhattan firm Architecture Research Office. Mr. Cassell, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Members of Congress aren't the only ones struggling with deadlines. The folks behind the Academy Awards have announced they will postpone the deadline for Oscar nominations by one day, to this Friday. Apparently, the first ever electronic voting at the Academy is off to a rocky start, and that could lead to record low turnout among Oscar voters this year, which could affect who gets to go home with that 8.5-pound gold-plated statuette. Here's Marketplace's Amy Scott.
For 84 years, Oscar voters cast paper ballots sent by mail. Pete Hammond writes the awards column for Deadline.com. He says the big concern was security.
The Academy is like the CIA or something. It's a really tempting target to try to break the secrecy of the Oscars.
That's why the new electronic system has a heavy firewall. Hammond says he's heard from several members who've had trouble logging in.
So this could depress the voting turnout if people get frustrated and they say, the hell with that, I'm not going to vote.
The company that makes the voting system says it's working flawlessly and chalked any problems up to incorrect or forgotten passwords. The Motion Picture Academy is giving members an extra day to sort out any glitches. Scott Feinberg is awards analyst at The Hollywood Reporter. He's heard complaints from members of all ages, but he says if older, less tech-savvy voters give up, it could skew the nominations.
And it might give a slight advantage to an edgier kind of movie like a Moonrise Kingdom or a movie like The Master, which a lot of particularly older voters weren't crazy about, but younger people tended to like more.
But big studio films with big marketing budgets may have another advantage. Voting started 10 days earlier this year, so Academy members had less time to watch everything. One director I talked to, who's on the short list for Best Documentary, says he's just wondering who's actually seen his film. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And finally, on Facebook today, we asked you all about your New Year's resolutions money-wise. I told everybody I was starting small this year, like giving up those $3.55 lattes at Starbucks. One of you suggested I will only last a week. I think that was another latte addict who said that. Others offered their money resolutions, including drink water instead of soda, eat out less, pay for more things with cash instead of plastic, and I loved this one, get a promotion. That's from Carlos in Newark. Carlos, let us know how it turns out. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Mary Dew, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Sarah Gardner. Happy 2013, everybody. We hope you can join us again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.